We'll open this prayer discussion with prayer. Father, I would not think only of myself or pray only for myself, as now I seek thy presence. I would remember before thee all my brothers and sisters who need thy help. Especially I think of those who are faced by great temptations, of those who are faced by tasks too great for their powers, of those who stand in any valley of decision, of those who are in debt or poverty, of those who are suffering the consequences of misdeeds long ago repented of those who by reason of early surroundings have never had a fair chance in life, of all family circles broken by death, of all missionaries of the kingdom of heaven in faraway corners of the earth, of those who lift high the lamp of truth in lonely places. Dear Father of mankind, make me the human channel so far as in me lies, through which thy divine love and pity may reach the hearts and lives of a few of those who are near me now. Amen. It seems, I know it's sort of presumptuous and almost, I think, probably for me to talk to you about prayer. Most of you probably know much more about it than I, and are much, probably far better prayer warriors than I. But I'm a scientist. Some people refer me as a sort of a biological scientist in residence here now for a few weeks, but I haven't gotten around to that yet. Maybe next week. But I think this is a very important subject, and I've wanted the chief, because of some experiences she's had, to get going in a prayer group. And there are many of you who also have been involved in this, and I want you to get involved in this thing. And the reason I think it's important is the subject of all of this now, as I unravel my scroll. What I've done, I collect up material on this, and I've sort of glued it all together this morning. Gene Swihart helped me, and we found some scotch tape, and we glued it all together. Now, I hope it makes some kind of a story, but a true one. It seems to me at least sometimes, that the forgotten man in society today is the inner man. Action seems to be the order of the day. One crisis after another claims our attention, commands our energies, and demands our response. Quiet times and seasons of reflection seem, if not treasonable, at least sort of people who do this manifest disinterest or slothfulness in time of crisis-ridden world. In other words, you kind of look down on these people. I feel one of the great condemnations of our society today is that we have so little privacy, and most people haven't even missed it. I think a summer ago, I led a discussion in privacy. We had a very interesting time about this. We seem more and more to be living from the outside rather than from the inside. A big issue today is the quality of life. But what kind of quality of life are we talking about? It's the ecology of the outside, the quality of our environment. When ecos is really means house, you know, and I'd be more concerned about what's inside the house. I believe a real proof of this statement is our own uneasiness with prayer. In many churches today, our commitment to prayer is only really only half-hearted. And it's kind of a hit-and-miss proposition. And I talked with our Holden hero number one about this last night. And I told him what I was going to do today. And he said that, he says, even here at Holden, we get so busy with things and we neglect our prayer life sometimes. It seems that our own age here has sort of outgrown prayer. We don't pray for before examinations anymore. We study for them or we figure out some way to cheat. We don't pray for rain we seed the clouds. We don't pray for sleep, we go to the medicine cabinet. When a member of the family is ill, we do not indulge in incantations. We try to call up the best physician we can find and hope he'll give us the latest miracle drug. When there's trouble involving a sort of friction between people and personalities, say in the office, we don't think about praying, we organize sensitivity groups. We don't pray for peace anymore, we send Henry Kissinger. And that's how we go, you know. Our church bodies have constructed fantastic edifices. They've built bulging bureaucracies. They've accumulated considerable wealth in some places. They've mastered many techniques and accumulated a rather impressive amount of brain power. And they've published many position papers. But sometimes with all of this, there seems to be so little accomplished that I am moved to say, never did so many labor with so much for so little. And I've diagnosed at least part of the problem in many quarters as this. And Jesus said, without me you can do nothing. Or as Paul said in Timothy, we have a form of godliness, but we deny the power thereof. We suffer from the sterility of abandoned prayer. Or if we pray, we too often forget the prayer of joy. And it's a little incident, I think I mentioned it at our banquet in Minneapolis that we had such a good time at in January. And the occasion here, what was it that I'm going to tell you about, it happened in a church. It was during prayers, and there was a small child who was turning around and smiling at everyone in church. He wasn't really tearing up any hymn books, going through his mother's purse. He wasn't even picking his nose or kicking or spitting. He wasn't even humming or gurgling. He was just smiling. Finally, his mother jerked him around in a stage whisper that you could have heard way outside. She said, stop that grinning. You're in church. And with that, she gave him a belt on his beehiver, and tears rolled down his cheeks, and he kind of sat there still crying, and she said, that's better, and returned to her prayers. Now, what must this little child think of our age in our church? We sing, make a joyful noise unto the Lord, but then the look on our faces suggests that a rich aunt has just died and left everything to her pregnant cat instead of our favorite charity, which is ourselves. Our first response should be, we have to get this mother and child to Holden where we can tell them about our God, the happy God, the God who had to have a sense of humor to create the likes of us. A God who understands little children who pick their noses in church because they're bored. Or even understands our shallow prayers when we implore, if you can't make me thin, Lord, at least make my friends look fat. Well, I thought at this point we should look and see what the Bible has to say about it. It's a good source that we sometimes neglect, too. And I've deduced that there are two general truths about prayer. The first is that it was a very vital part of Jesus' life. And the second is that he intended it to be a vital part of ours. Two pretty simple truths. I cheer the movement to change the age-old image of a benign Jesus with a Mona Lisa smile. Now he's cast as a revolutionary, applying power tactics, setting up confrontations, and crusading against the establishment. This image remaking is also wrong if we do not recognize that from first to last, Jesus was a man of prayer. Not an atypical day for him, was one in Capernaum. He taught in the synagogue, he cast out demons. He went from there to a house and he healed Peter's mother-in-law. That evening after sundown, the whole town turned out with their afflicted people and it filled up the whole place. You couldn't get in. And after all this, he got up very early the next morning and he went out to a very lonely spot. I'm sure on the way he watched some birds. And he remained there to pray. He prayed for children. He prayed before he worked miracles. Before he chose his disciples, prayed in the garden, he prayed on the cross. The disciples asked him, teach us to pray. Now, I think they must have been really impressed with his prayer life. I couldn't find anywhere in the Bible, and maybe it's there, but the disciples didn't say to Jesus, teach us how to teach us how to pray, or teach us how to work miracles. But they did say, teach us how to pray. And Jesus wanted us to talk with God as he did. He said we should go into the closet, into seclusion and concentration, that we must concentrate on our prayers. At this point, I'm reminded what an old tent pastor told us one time. In telling us the importance of prayer and concentrating on what we're saying, and he told about an old preacher he knew who was teaching these sort of backwoodsy people about prayer, and he had taught them the Lord's Prayer. And then as a challenge to one of the old fellows there, he says, I'll tell you what I'll do. If you can say the Lord's Prayer clear through, he says, I'll give you a horse, a riding horse. And so the fellow was delighted at this because he had memorized this prayer then. And he started in, Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done. Will you give me the saddle too? And that's how we do it sometimes, you know. He said prayer was a matter of quality, not quantity. He said we shouldn't become involved in vain repetitions, in babblings like the heathen. The true object of Christian prayer is not that God's will may be changed, but that his will may be done. Prayer was not meant to be a burden to us, but a privilege in which we richly share. Some other aspects of prayer I've made notes on here. Our prayers are often, or too often, Hear, Lord, for thy servant speaketh, instead of Speak, Lord, thy servant heareth. We too often give the message and then hang up the phone. And Carol has so appropriately reminded us of one of our great tragedies, and it is this, that most men and women expect so little of God. And what I'm saying today reflects a lot of what Wes said this morning, for those of you who were at Matins. And the Bible verse he said really fits in here. That we shouldn't be afraid to ask. Pray not to change other people's lives, but your own first. Prayer must be a practice in honesty. Let your fortresses crumble and stand free. And don't be afraid, you know, to bother God with details. And in this regard, I want to read you something that I'm giving Mary. Mary's my chief theological consultant from the standpoint of which books we should read. And now and then I try to find her a good one. And this one is very meaningful for her because John Bailey was a friend of her father's. And John Bailey has done some very interesting things. I'm going to mention something later, too. But in his little devotional booklet here, there's one thing on to pray and not to faint. And he says, is there someone who altogether fails to face his lot with an equal mind? Are you near to fainting, near to losing heart? Are you overborne with labor or worn out with worry? or consumed with hopeless longing, then won't you take your Lord's advice? Don't try to keep the whole thing pent up within your own heart. Share it with God. Tell him all about it, yes, down to the last and absurdest annoying detail. And then he quotes a Bible verse, "In nothing be anxious, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be known unto God." And he spake a parable unto them to this end, that men ought always to pray and not to faint, or not to lose heart. You must pray and not lose heart. In fact, that's the Bible verse for this particular talk that he gave, that you pray and not lose heart. You must enjoy being yourself, not wishing you were someone else or praying that you could be someone else, but to be yourself. And I was impressed with what Paul said in 1 Timothy. He speaks there of four aspects of prayer open to the believer. It goes like this. First of all, then, I urge that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and thanksgiving be made for all men. And so I want to just take those four briefly and discuss them a bit. Supplication to me means literally begging. It's a petition of the sinner for forgiveness. I believe we have an example of this in Matthew 15, when that poor Canaanite woman begs Jesus that he will heal her daughter. And the disciples are trying to, you know, close the gate on her. They're trying to get her out of there because she's bothering things. She's making a lot of noise. And also Jesus, we're almost shook up the way Jesus sort of puts her off. He says some almost really unkind things to her, but she hangs in there. And then he says, "Great is your faith. Be it done to you as you desire." And it was. For her daughter was healed instantly. The second one, he just says it's a prayer. What is called a prayer here, I interpret as a prayer of confidence by obedient children of God. It is a claim to the promises of God. It is the right and duty of every child of God. The third one, it's spoken of in this verse, is intercession. It is the third form of prayer and the highest form of prayer for others. It's the prayer of one who is willing to take the place of the one for whom he is praying. It is a plea for the cause of another, as if it were his own or her own. There's a great example of this in the Old Testament, when Moses prays for forgiveness for the sins of his people. He's praying earnestly for them. And then to really make the point with God, he makes this very significant statement. "You know what, God, if you don't forgive these people, blot me, I pray thee, out of thy book." He was willing to take their place if they could be spared. Paul did this too in praying that his people would accept Christ. "I could wish myself were accursed before Christ for my brethren, my kinsmen, according to the flesh." The perfect example, of course, is Christ himself. He really did take the place of those for whom he prayed. God could not forgive the Israelites by blotting Moses really out. Writing him out of the book sort of thing. Nor could he convert Paul's Jewish friends by separating Paul from Christ. I mean, this was really impossible to do. But God can forgive all sinners because Jesus not only prayed for them, he died for them. By intercessory prayer, we may be able to obtain for others what they cannot obtain for themselves. I know in my own case, I owe much in my life to the intercessory prayer of others, many who I don't even know about. And I guess that's the beautiful thing about it. The fourth prayer or supplication or type of prayer here is the one of giving thanks.
And that's one we often ignore. When Jesus prayed for the raising of Lazarus, a very interesting dissertation there, or the description. Because before he ever tells Lazarus, you know, to get up, you know the prayer he's already said, Father, I thank thee that thou hast heard me. And then he asks Lazarus to get up. And it's only with the prayer that healing really takes place. Remember, I think it was the 10 lepers, wasn't it? And 9 went away. Their leprosy was removed. But one came back and gave thanks. And that was the only one that was really healed. And then there's a discipline in prayer, I think. Discipline is based on a realization that nothing that I know works on a hit or miss fashion. Prayer is too important a force to ignore or just to take hit and miss. And I know of no one who became proficient in anything without diligent effort. And I think that we often pray amiss. And I thought here I'd give you, you know, in my own experience, what I try to do, and, you know, I goof up a lot. But the first thing in the morning, you know, when my feet hit the deck, and I'll admit, I'm type A guy. I wake up and I'm pretty alert in the morning, relatively speaking. But, you know, I'm done in at night. And so for me, this is easy. And as soon as my feet hit the deck, I thank God for the day, and then I pray, help me to live it in a meaningful way, in a manner pleasing in thy sight. And then I use Bailey, the prayer which I modified to open our discussion here. And John Bailey, the same one I read from a few moments ago, he wrote this diary of private prayer, and it's a prayer for every morning and every evening throughout the month. And it's very helpful to me, and then you have free prayer along with it, you see. And I'm going to leave one of these in the library for those of you who are not familiar with it, and you can become familiar with it. And from James Finn, they only cost about 40 cents. So you can buy 2, and when one wears out, you've got another one in reserve. Now, as I say, this isn't for everyone. And I got Chief's permission to say a few things here about her. When she gets up in the morning wants to get up when I have breakfast, I try to discourage this. But now and then she comes out and she turns one element on and puts the water on the other one. And one day, I usually have this instant carnation breakfast, you know, and I mix it with milk, stirred up, you know. And boy, you don't know what this is till somebody puts lemon juice in it, you know. Boy, I never tried that. Now, maybe the chief has discovered something great here. She didn't really mean to. And maybe it is really great, but I don't really go for it. So I just, you know, I don't really recommend it for the chief for early in the morning, because I wouldn't be too sure, but it might even be unintelligible to God. And then I try to have a short devotion in the morning by myself. The children have all gone now, and there's very little doing around my house at 5:30 and 6 in the morning. And then I keep a prayer list, which I told you about some of you the other day. And you keep adding names to this, and it gets pretty long. And then I've been impressed with the Bible verse that says, you know, pray without ceasing. And for a long time, this thing bothered me, you know. You can't get much done if you spend the whole day praying. Although, I will say, one of my buttons today is, in your heart, you know he's right. And it's Luther, the picture of Luther. And he was right. He was wrong about a lot of things, but he was right about prayer, you know. As he got busier, he said, boy, when I really got busy, sometimes I'd have to spend half a day praying. And but this prayer without ceasing, how I interpret that is, you know, like, all right, so you write a letter, you know, and you're praying that this letter may be meaningful to the person you're writing to, and as you drop it in the box, you know, that it may be meaningful. Or in my life, with a lot of, you got to meet a lot of people and talk to them. People coming in, they always got problems, and before all of these, you pray for this. Or if you're driving along, you go by a school, you know, you pray for these teachers. Most people run teachers down. Maybe we should think about lifting them up. Or you go by a church, you know, everybody's teeing off on the pastor. Instead of maybe we ought to be praying for the pastor. If you drive through a tenement area, these people for whom, you know, life is just really a rotten kind of a thing for them, we ought to be praying for them. And this is sort of this prayer without ceasing. You know, you don't have to stop and face Mecca or something and get out the prayer rug. You know, you can, and this is how you do it. And on my way home in the evening, well, on the way to work in the morning, I go the long way around, and I'm very fortunate, and I can go 9 miles to work by the back road and maybe meet 1 to 3 cars and trucks. But on the way home, I'm usually late, so I take the short way home, and I really should take the long way home, because on the way home, what I try to do, it takes me 9 minutes, and I try to make those 9 minutes sort of a confession. But it isn't long enough, because, you know, I look at all the things I goofed up that day, and all the things I, you know, the people I wronged, and but it's helpful in this confession to do this, and maybe I should move out of town further, but do something. And the other thing about it, or I mentioned one of the things that happens here, you know, you say, well, it isn't up, you know, you drive by these places and pray for them. Like you drive by the convalescent home and say, boy, you know, there's some lonely people in there. You know, comfort them. That isn't enough, you know. And after you find out that you start praying for these people, pretty soon you're going in there and visiting them. You really find out what's going on. And that's a remarkable thing about prayer. And then at night, I know some of you probably are like me, something bugging you and you wake up in the middle of the night, or they're noisy up here in the jacuzzi pool and they wake you up, you know, somebody's having a hilarious time and you're not in on it and you're got late to bed and you got to get up early in the morning. Well, that's the time to get out your prayer list and see. You don't have to get out the list, you know. You have to go lay there and see if you can, how many of them you can go through. And that's a nice way to go to sleep, praying for these people who need help. It's better than the medicine cabinet, really. And then now a little word about Holden. Now, I remember talking to Wes Preeb, you know. You think of how we got this place. I'm sure there's some praying involved there. We still can't believe how we got it, you know. It is truly a miracle. And old Wes told me that he hadn't been up here. You know, he tried to get the place and he got it. And then he came up here with a bunch. He was sitting down there by number one, kind of looking over the place. And I'm sure he was probably as surprised as everybody else. And one pastor told him, he says, boy, you really got a white elephant here. There's nobody going to come here. There's no swimming pool. The youth, there's not going to be attraction to the youth here. You know, going through it. And we may well ask at this point, why has this place been such a help to so many? Why have so many lives been changed by having been here? Why is it such an exciting place where there's so much forgiving love and joy? Some of you say, maybe, well, you know, they say, in telling about this place, boy, you know, it's so beautiful, the setting's so wonderful, and the food is so great, you know, it keeps consistently, you know, it's really impressive. Or those of you who like to fish, boy, there, you know, there's really a lot of great places to go to fish. And the people that come here are so fine. The faculty is outstanding, you know. And the director and his wife are so brilliant. Facilities are pretty impressive, you know, and you total up the list. But I can go through all of these and say, well, I can name that place. You know, they got a, that's a great place too. It's pretty and everything. And the food is good there. And boy, there's some remarkable faculty there. Maybe it's true that, you know, the whole combination here. But I submit to you that in great part, the success of this place, if you call it success, is really prayer. Every day there's prayer here. There's intercessory prayer. There are all kinds of these prayers. Every day, not only in the summer, but Werner in the winter, and the groups here, they lead the prayer here. But it's not only here. It's throughout the United States and Canada. People are praying for this place in support of the director and Werner and all the people here. There's people who are continually in prayer for this place. Now, I've probably gone on long enough, and I'm going to conclude. I come off from a farm, and so I like to tell simple stories, sort of to make a point. And a homely little story, I identify at this point with a freckled-faced, poorly dressed, barefoot boy who was one day standing on the banks of the Mississippi River. He had, you know, old beaten-up clothes on and a crummy old hat. And his eyes seemed to be fixed upriver. And he was looking for a certain riverboat. And it came into view, and as soon as it came into view, he took off his tattered old hat and he started to wave it, like he was trying to wave it into shore. Looked kind of ridiculous, really. And he didn't know it, but there was a stranger standing behind him. And he couldn't stand any longer, and he says, you know, young fellow, you're crazy if you think that boat's coming in here to pick you up. And just as he'd said that, the boat veered sharply, came right into shore where the little boy was standing. And he just hopped on the boat and put his tattered hat back on his head, and boat pulled out, and he looked back to the stranger and said over the rail, he says, "Mister, I'm not crazy." He says, "My dad is the captain of this boat." And that's what I have to say about prayer today. I have entitled this the greatest mystery of them all, or musings on mystery. I was going to call it captured in mystery, but it will become evident that I'm not ready to call it that yet until it gets some feedback and polish. Or the fellowship of mystery. And that comes from the Scripture, Ephesians 3:9 and on through 11. And to make all men see what is the fellowship of the mystery which from the beginning of the world had been hid in God who created all things by Jesus Christ. To the intent that now unto the principalities and powers in the heavenly places might be known by the church the manifold wisdom of God, according to the eternal purpose which he purposed in Christ Jesus
our Lord, in whom we have boldness and access with confidence by faith in Him. The beauty of the fellowship of mystery. Let us pray. May the words of my lips, the meditation of our hearts, be acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Now, I always believe in giving my listeners, I tell the students this, the benefit of having an outline before them, and I couldn't give you an outline. But you can tell sort of when I'm reaching near the end, because the bottom will kind of disappear here, you see, and it'll accumulate over here. So you'll know where I am, generally. And I hope I do, too. Now, by mystery, I mean something beyond human understanding. There are mysteries everywhere in science and religion. Mystery induces awe and wonder. It stimulates imagination and investigation. It calls for faith. It was exciting for me to think about it, as I have now for a couple of years. A couple of things really got me going on this subject. The first was here at Howden, when two very significant statements were made that intrigued me. The first one was made by one of the greatest spirits of Howden, Horty Christman. Well, if you don't know, you should meet him. He is a philosopher, theologian, plumber, barber, truck driver, carpenter, actor, and counselor. And about Holden, he said, if we'd understood this place, we'd have spoiled it. And by this, I think he meant the leaven that is here and how it works is a mystery. The other statement was made by Carol Hinderly when he said, people come to the village disturbed because they do not understand. And they leave Holden rejoicing that they do not understand. Why? Because they have learned to live in the fellowship of mystery. The second thing that really got me going on this mystery kick goes back many years, and it requires a bit of explanation. For many years when I attended the American Lutheran Church, not infrequently the best sermon of the day was written on the back of the bulletin. They were written by Al Rognes. And the first time that I met Al, I said, you must put this into writing, collect them into a book. Many other people also told Al this. And sometime after this, I received a book in the mail. It was entitled Captured in Mystery, which was a selected collection of these sermonettes by Al. And about this book, I must say this. I don't recall ever presenting a vesper or preparing a sermon in which I did not look in this book and often quote from this book. When I first opened this book, and on the inside of the flyleaf were these words, to Leo, who in spite of his laboratories is still captured in mystery. It was more than I deserved. But I must say this to you, Al. You must share in the results of this evening. You must share in the blame for some of what I have to say tonight. For the credit for what good there might be in it belongs to God. As I was listening to John last night, and when you listen to John, you better listen carefully because every word counts. I recalled something from a remarkable book that has been little read. It is called The Greeks and the Irrational. Early in this book, the author Dodds recalls that while visiting in the British Museum and looking at some Grecian sculpture, a young man came up to him and said, "I know it's an awful thing, but this Greek stuff doesn't move me a bit." And by way of explanation, he said, "It's so terribly rational. Unlike African and Aztec art, it appears to lack the awareness of mystery and ability to penetrate the deeper, less conscious levels of human experience." And I think you should have gleaned that from John's exposé last night on what he discussed. In this age of science and technology, except for a few books like Rumor of Angels, I fear that mystery, especially having to do with religion, has departed from the modern world. At least that is how some dramatic pronouncements like "God is dead" in the post-Christian era would make us believe. Herman Kahn of the Hudson Institute, in making his projections for the last third of this century, managed to do so with only a passing mention of religion. He pronounced that our culture would become more sensate, that it would become more empirical, this worldly, secular, humanistic, pragmatic, utilitarian, contractual, Epicurean, and hedonistic. And the death of the supernatural was met in many quarters with gleeful triumph. And as I said yesterday, one of the great condemnations of our civilization is that the real feel for the mystery has left us, and nobody seems to have missed it. Fortunately, truth, higher truth, is not dependent on the vote of the majority or on Herman Kahn. The Bible speaks much of mystery. In Proverbs are these beautiful words: "There are three things which are too wonderful for me, yea, four which I know not: the way of an eagle in the air, the way of a serpent upon a rock, the way of a ship in the midst of the sea, and the way of a man with a maid." There are countless unanswered questions. They are shrouded in mystery. Where did God come from? How could he create all things? Who sustaineth the planets, the stars, and the orbits? In my own situation, in the laboratories in which I work, what is the real mechanism of carcinogenesis? What is the secret of this dread disease? What is the real mechanism of the radiation effect? Or in my own home, I am moved to say with Sigmund Freud, who after 39 years said, "What does a woman want?" In Daniel are these words: "The possession of a secret is set forth as a special gift of God, showing his favor." In Matthew, Mark, and Luke are these same words. That is, they're the same in all three. And they're weighty words. "Unto you it is given to know the mystery of the kingdom of God." In Timothy are these words: "And without controversy, great is the mystery of godliness. God was manifest in the flesh, justified in the spirit, seen of angels, preached unto the Gentiles, believed on in the world, and received up into glory." Paul used the word mystery 21 times in his epistles. And his audiences knew the word. Paul and many of his audiences were familiar with the secret religious mystery cults of their time. And it was the language of the day, and I won't go into these cults. In Romans, he said, "For I would not, brethren, that you should be ignorant of this mystery, lest you should be wise in your own conceit." And also this: "Now to him that is of power to establish you according to my gospel, and the preaching of Jesus Christ according to the revelation of mystery, which was kept secret since the world began. And in Colossians are these words which I'm going to repeat again, but they're very significant words. To whom God would make known what is the riches of the glory of this mystery among the Gentiles, which is Christ in you, the hope of glory. And to make all men see what is the fellowship of the mystery, which was from the beginning of the world, hath been hid in God, who created all things by Jesus Christ. This to the Ephesians. Now I face this task this evening with some fear and trepidation, realizing that we are stewards of the mysteries of God, which is the life principle of the church, and that any talk of it is but a stammering, for it is indescribable and inexhaustible. The mystery has no place in the world of visible things. It cannot be neatly cataloged or understood by rational cognition. It is alien to any sober understanding of this empirical world. Yet it penetrates and can burst the bubble of every moralistic, philosophical, or logical system. And as I approach it, I also realize that we face one world, the world of every day, the only world God gives us at the moment. And in this one world, we face the transcendent mystery, which is its deepest dimension. Now, in my readings, I have learned many things about mystery. And one of the things that I have found is that many people are very fond of mysteries. And certainly we see that in my laboratories. I see it in myself, as even on Saturday night and sometimes Sunday morning, it's still exciting. The chief, that's my wife, and my older daughter, Karen, are two of these people who are very fond of mystery stories. I admonish them periodically that there are better things to read. So now it has become sort of a game between us. Recently I asked the chief what she was reading, and she said she was reading Dorothy Sayers. You see, the chief knows that I am very fond of the late Dorothy Sayers, who was a great spokesman for Christianity, a great theologian, which we discussed last layman seminar, and we had a great time with Dorothy Sayers. She makes an outstanding case for it in many of her books. One of my favorites is Creed or Chaos, and I have introduced some people to it, and they were never the same again. She also writes mystery stories. And she has become most famous for these. And so I asked the chief what this book was about, and she said it was about a bishop. It was a mystery story about a bishop. You see, when you've lived with somebody for almost 30 years, when you can't remember really when you weren't with her, as a part of her, you get to know some of these things. Some mysteries are revealed. And so this introduces one of the great mysteries, that having to do with interpersonal relationships with man and wife, husband and wife, which I referred to, which I read to you from Proverbs. The relationship is only vital and vibrant when there is mystery. When it's just routine, when it's all just a matter of fact, it's boredom. And as Carol keeps reminding you, that's another name for hell. This was a concern which I expressed a few weeks ago when meeting again with Paul Tournier. You see, he suggested in his book, in Secrets, that there should not be any secrets between man and wife. And I wasn't ready to buy this, nor was my wife. And I mentioned this to him last year when I talked to him about this. And he says, I still believe that, and I still would write that. He says, it's something you must shoot for. And so I thought about this for a whole year. And it was about some weeks ago, and I saw him again. You know, but if you share all these secrets and, you know, there's nothing known, you know, then there's no mystery. You reduce the sense of mystery, which is the solid basis for an exciting relationship. He said the opposite was true. It would only deepen the mystery. And you know that's true, because I take it to the laboratory. And you know, I have found this certainly to be true there. For if I have a little knowledge of a subject, I draw a little circle around this knowledge. And there's just so many question marks I can put around this circle. But as my knowledge expands, there are many more question marks that go around that circle. Good research is defined as one that raises more questions and more questions than are answered. So what he said was really true. So don't despair. Share your secrets. Now, most mysteries and most mystery stories are all alike. They begin or end with a major crime. Usually it's a murder. The mystery is usually who did it. And you can rest assured that it is never the person that you think it is. Every literary device is utilized to mislead you. And when the mystery is finally revealed, it is usually the one you least expected. And you can get all wrapped up in it because you know it's fiction. You see, the agony of fact is missing. You know it really didn't happen. My wife and our daughter Karen also enjoy the skill with which Dorothy Sayers weaves this web of mystery. But most of all, their enjoyment lies in the state of excitement which the suspense of not knowing who did it. And it builds up to a climax. The story of Jesus is a mystery, but it's different. And it's the greatest mystery of them all. But there the similarity ends. In this story, the victim is not killed by the bad guys, the gangsters, but by the good guys, the so-called good guys who represented the best interests of a great religious tradition and one of the most enlightened of political institutions. This story is not fiction. It is something that actually happened. They are facts, and they cause us to tremble. When you really think about it, it really shakes you up. And in this story, there is no mystery about who did it. We know who did it. We know them by name, and it was an impressive lot. It was Judas, one of the 12, who was probably the best educated. He was treasure for the disciples. There was Pilate, the Roman governor, Caiaphas, the high priest, King Herod, the Sanhedrin, the soldiers, and the crowd who preferred Barabbas. Today, it is us. We, the people, still crucify him. This mystery concentrates on one man. Everybody seemed to know who he was, or they thought they knew who he was. He was a carpenter's son from Nazareth. His mother was named Mary, and he had brothers and sisters who were known around Galilee. But even knowing all this, they were never quite sure who he really was, because there was something mysterious about him. On hearing him speak, they said, "Never man spake as this man." After a stormy night in a boat, they said, "Who then is this, that even the wind and the sea obey him?" And a Roman soldier with no apparent religious schooling on seeing him die on the cross said, "Truly this was the Son of God." But as the song that we may yet sing but they never know who he was. Still haunts us. And on handling the question about Jesus Christ, it cannot be separated from the continually changing understanding which we have of ourselves and of the world by inspection. He comes to us as one unknown without a name, as of old by the lakeside. He came to those who knew him not. He speaks to us the same word, or the words, "Follow me." And he sets us to the task which he has to fulfill for our time. And he commands, and to those who obey him, whether they be wise or simple, he will reveal himself in the toils, the conflicts, and the sufferings which they shall pass through in his fellowship. And as an ineffable mystery, they shall learn in their own experience who he is, who he is. And as you hear these beautiful words of Albert Schweitzer, you must also hear those of Carol Hinderly, when he said, beyond knowing and beyond experience, there is believing, there is the word, and there is the sacrament. Now, beside not knowing who he was, many don't know where he is. Many of us, perhaps everyone at some time or another, are moved to cry in desperation with Job, "Oh, that I knew where I might find him." And then one day, someplace, we reach the point that we realize that we can't find God, but God, through Christ, has found us. This is the glorious message of the gospel. But this message does not dispel the mystery, but it establishes truth. It establishes truth within the mystery. And he who accepts this truth in faith will be captured by this mystery, will be sustained by it, and held by it with more certainty than by knowledge and facts. The truth about God received in faith is a far higher truth than that which I obtain in my laboratories. And the strangest thing about it, about all of this mystery, is that it is never solved. The story never ends. The man who is killed lives on. There was the empty tomb. Questions arose. Was the body stolen? Some believe that it was. Or did it come to life again? Some thought that it did. Some still think that it did. The number who believe that it did numbers into the millions. After finding an empty tomb, his friends began to meet him in different places, sometimes in different places at the same time, and they didn't always recognize him. It could be that they weren't expecting to see him. He entered rooms through doors that were closed, yet he had breakfast with some of them on the shore of the lake. But wherever they met him, those who met him, having seen him, changed their lives completely. The difference between the men who forsook Christ and fled from the Garden of Gethsemane and those who a few weeks later were neither silenced nor intimidated by prison, torture, or death was astounding. Yet they were the same men, but something most assuredly had changed them. And they were so certain for the reason for this change, they chose death to denying it. And their experience has been perpetuated until today. There are several other fantastic things about this mystery. For us who live on the edge of this great mystery, like the question of God and the question of Jesus, they have a strange power to grasp and to hold, a power which never ceases to surprise. This power lasts in its authenticity only as long as it is allowed to retain its mystery. And it is not misused by those who seek to extend their personal certainties into areas where it is no longer legitimate to press them. Another strange thing about this mystery of Jesus and of God, is that it does not cease to be a mystery even when it is revealed. It remains inconceivable, unutterable, unsearchable, and incomprehensible. It can be proclaimed and testified, and it must. It can be betrayed. It must never be betrayed. The divine mystery is not the communication of supernatural knowledge, but rather the presence of God in this world. The mystery is a historical event, Christ as God entering history, as the eternal Son of the Father, who as a man became our brother. He is the image of the invisible God who has become visible to us. The mystery is unfolded, revealed to us only as we become partakers in this new and incomparable fellowship with one another in mystery. The divine mystery is the mystery of divine love, and it cannot be known unless we are drawn into this love, and we show this love to one another by ready service and sacrifice to our neighbor. And the most glorious part of this mystery, the most fantastic part of it, is that the life that was and is in him can be in us. It can be in the likes of you and me. And that's what St. Paul said to the Colossians, to whom God would make known what is the riches of the glory of this mystery among the Gentiles, which is Christ in you, the hope of glory. And you know, we might just pull this off if we follow this suggestion. If we live with Christ in us, to live as if what Jesus said about his Father were true, if we lived as if the life he lived, marked by compassion and forgiveness, were true, if you did this, you may just conclude that this is real life, that living in the fellowship of this mystery, and realize then that living in this mystery is the way things were meant to be. That's the way they were meant to be. Amen.